Welcome to Scope It Out. In this episode, Dr. Smith will be speaking with Dr. Stella Lee on her article, The Association of Pollutants and Allergic and Non-Allergic Rhinitis in Chronic Rhinosinusitis. Scope It Out is made possible by support from FIAGON and Karl Storz Endoscopy America.
Hello and welcome to Scope It Out, the podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host, Dr. Tim Smith, and today I'm very happy to be joined by Dr. Stella Lee from Pittsburgh, and we will be discussing her article, which is currently available in Early View online, entitled The Association of Air Pollutants and Allergic and Non-Allergic Rhinitis in Chronic Rhinosinusitis. Stella, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tim, for having me.
Yeah, for sure. So tell me, this is one of those topics that actually I don't know a lot about. I mean, one of the many topics, I should say, that I don't know a lot about.
That's surprising.
No, not at all. But, you know, it's one of these things that I've thought about my entire career, and that is how air pollutants are impacting our patients. I just haven't seen a lot written about it in the literature. I imagine maybe there's more in the asthma literature, but I haven't seen a lot in the rhinology literature about this. I'm interested in how you became interested in this particular topic.
Yes, so I came to Pittsburgh in 2011, and there was just a really interesting article in our Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and it was called Mapping Mortality. And the concern was that people that were living near these coke factories and other kind of diesel power plants, people were dying at an increased rate compared to other locations where the air quality was better. And it's, you know, hard to prove causation, but they really did look at certain factors in the air and looked at particular diseases such as lung disease and lung cancer and heart disease and particularly asthma as well. And they found that people were dying at a much higher rate than other people. And so this really stimulated a question in my mind about, could this be contributing to chronic rhinosinusitis as well? Because it's all interconnected. And I had heard from my patients, too, who live in these areas, that they seem to have more severe disease and had more refractory symptoms and required more surgery. But I didn't have the data, so I wanted to really study it a little bit more rigorously.
That's very interesting. I was born, actually, in West Virginia, in Morgantown,
oh, wow.
West Virginia. Yeah, my dad was in graduate school there at WVU, but my grandparents lived in Charleston, West Virginia, which is where one of the major carbide plants was. And I remember going back there as a kid to visit my grandparents, and you would drive through one, we always drove, you know, in a station wagon across the country and took 4 days to get there. But
right.
I remember very distinctly driving through West Virginia, and you would drive through one part of the state and it was absolutely pristine and some of the most beautiful country that I'd seen in the United States. And then you'd get to another town where the smell from the pollution in the town, you could hardly imagine that people lived there, but they did. And
right.
it seemed to happen like that through various portions of the state. And I guess you do live in the area we call the Iron Belt, right? There's a history of significant pollution in that part of the country, although I understand it's cleaned up quite a lot in more recent years.
Yes, so Pittsburgh, now the major industries here are actually health, the top two are healthcare and education, but many years ago it used to be the steel mills. But unfortunately, even though the sky looks blue, we know that Pittsburgh has one of the worst quality indices in the country. And it's because of PM2.5, which is small particulate matter and black carbon, but other measures too. I just looked on the EPA website just to look at where you are sitting, Tim, and where I am, and what the PM levels are. And your air quality is considered quite good. Your air quality index is 29, and ours is moderate, which is up in the 70s. So it's definitely there's a difference, even though physically you might not see that.
Yeah. So anecdotally, have you noticed as you've looked around the country, have you noticed that patients there just have more upper airway disease?
Or, they do. Yeah. And I've trained across the country. I haven't lived here my whole life.
Right.
So I have seen other places. And Pittsburgh, comparatively, I would say patients have more symptomatology. Sometimes when the testing, for example, the allergy testing is negative, or, for example, in this paper on looking specifically at polyps, that we still don't know what causes polyps, but the same is true also for patients without polyps. We found that in our study that patients, for example, who have non-allergic rhinitis, who don't have positive allergy testing, and they go into this wastebasket diagnosis of idiopathic
yeah.
rhinitis or non-allergic rhinitis. And in the other paper that we just published about CRS, that patients without polyps specifically have, it seems like there's a correlation with higher particulate matter and black carbon exposure than the other groups.
Has anyone studied Beijing or New Delhi, these places around the world that we all hear about massive problems with air pollution? Has anyone studied those populations with regard to upper airway disease that you're aware of?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's where our studies will go next. I would really be interested in collaborating with rhinologists or allergists and pulmonologists in other cities, and to map the data, do a prospective study to actually look at the exposure levels and disease severity in different areas. And on that vein, we do have some data from Menlo Park near where Dr. Peter Wong is over in Stanford. So we're also collaborating with Carnegie Mellon University here, where they have a little mobile van that goes around and measures air pollutant levels.
So what kind of air is Peter breathing right now?
Yeah, I know. So we are just collecting that data now. And Peter will share his sinus disease severity outcome measures, and then we'll map it to the air pollution measurements.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would be great to also have an international type of a study
right.
to look at that. But Beijing, I know they have a really big problem. Their PM levels are over 70 micrograms, which is really high.
Right. And you were just saying, just for reference, were you saying that Pittsburgh, you were referencing a different type of air quality in Pittsburgh when you said it was 70-something?
Oh, right. So the AQI is called the Air Quality Index, and that's a combination of several things, including ozone, the PM2.5, which is a small particle, a pollutant that can lodge in the upper and lower airways and cause disease. And then there's PM10, which is 10 micrograms, and then carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, and there are six principal pollutants that are indicators of air quality in this country, but the other countries have different indices as well. So it makes it a bit of a challenge to compare. What I was mentioning with the microgram was actually the PM2.5 levels.
Right, and, which is a particulate matter that
yeah,
you can measure in the air.
Level. And 12 is what the primary standard is defined as, where you don't want to go above that.
You don't want to go above 12, but you said Beijing is around 70-something.
Yeah, so the EPA for the U.S. has established, it's a national ambient air quality standard, at which a pollutant level is considered hazardous to your health. So
yeah.
You don't want that level to go above 12. And Beijing is about 70.
Well, do you know what Pittsburgh is offhand for that the particulate matter? I'm just curious to give people
yeah, so in our paper, we actually looked at different measurements ranges and then tried to compare it to disease severity. And it appeared that patients who are at the very higher levels, definitely over, we did tertiles, but we also did continuous variables to look at the entire spectrum of pollutants. And it seemed that patients who had exposures higher than 12, definitely, but in one of the figures we show that it's not as high as 70. It's definitely around the 20s, less than 20. It's not
okay.
incredibly high, but it's
right,
still
right.
above what we would say is not healthy.
Yeah, yeah. But that's interesting. That gives an interesting perspective to a city like Beijing, which is multiple, six times that level. Amazing.
Max for our CRS without polyp group was about 16.6 or about 17. So that gives you kind of a frame of reference.
Right, right. So what are the major takeaways, do you think, from your study for the practicing clinician? Like, what information would they take away from this that might be useful for them?
Right. So this was truly a pilot study. We didn't even know if we would find anything that was interesting. From the study, we do have some clues that air quality could be certainly playing a role in how symptomatic patients are and how severe their disease is. And this doesn't take into account what patients are doing outside of their home. I mean, the geocoding that we did, we were able to measure the values, the pollution exposures within 300 meters surrounding each house. But a lot of us spend a chunk of our time outside, you know, at work. And so I think it's important to realize that chronic rhinosinusitis and allergic rhinitis, specifically what we're finding is in CRS without polyposis and with non-allergic rhinitis or idiopathic rhinitis, when all the testing is negative and we can't really pinpoint what it might be, it could be an environmental exposure. We can't say that for certain, but we're finding some interesting clues that there may be a correlation.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree that this diagnosis of non-allergic rhinitis, I mean, sometimes we call it vasomotor rhinitis, but it really is a kind of a wastebasket diagnosis. We just don't know exactly what's going on in that particular group of patients necessarily, but I've always wondered about pollutants causing some proportion of that disease, and it seems like your study points to that concept, that in fact pollution may in fact be contributing there. And I can only imagine that even though you didn't find it in your study, that even patients who have polyposis and even patients who have positive allergy testing, I mean, the pollutant irritant factor is just one more factor that is piling on the inflammation in those then that particular patient population.
Yes, absolutely, especially with black carbon. And there are patients who I know who, and also we know that these pollutants do impact lower airway disease. There is a bigger body of data on asthma and lung cancer, increasing mortality. Yes. But as far as even my patients that I know who are exposed, in Pennsylvania, for example, there's a big fracking kind of pattern right now for natural gas, and interestingly, I do have a subset of patients who are exposed to lots of fumes and volatile organic compounds and particulate matter, too, from all the dust, and I'm seeing much more severe disease, both CRS with and without polyps, so that's something that I think is worthy of further study, because occupational exposures are certainly important, too.
Right, right. Do you have issues with patients seeking disability for this kind of exposure? And, I mean, what I would imagine is you would have patients seeking disability, but we don't have a lot of evidence to tie the two together, so it can be a difficult thing to demonstrate or to argue for the patient that, in fact, pollution has caused disability because of upper airway disease.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I just had a patient yesterday who I know is exposed to multiple volatile organic compounds and small particulate matter. He has very severe polyposis. We did surgery. And I said, what are you doing? And he's working in the fracking industry. We have a lot of patients here who work in the oil field, too, and in fracking. And I said, what kinds of protective measures are you using out there? Are you actually wearing high filtration masks and protective gear in general? And he said, no, the company that he's working for, which is one of the major companies that is here in Pennsylvania, they said just this year just implemented some safety measures for that. So I think eventually if we do come to find more interesting data and more correlative data, I think it would be helpful even on a policy level for the protection of patients, because it's a matter also, I think, of overall social justice and health. These patients are exposed to these things, but they don't have any means to really voice their concerns. And I didn't even bring up OSHA. I thought that OSHA would be involved in these types of issues, but apparently not. So
it reminds me of a summer job I had in college. I worked for the National Institutes for Occupational Safety and Health, which is like OSHA. I just don't think that they have the ability to sanction, whereas OSHA has the ability to sanction. NIOSH goes in and does the studies and informs corporations and employees of those corporations about the exposures, but I'm not sure that they can sanction it. But some of the environments that I went into, some of the working environments that I went into, I just will never forget how unbelievably dirty these environments were and wondered about the health consequences of these environments.
Yes.
And I lived in Ohio at the time, so there's various industries across that state, and I would travel across the state with a group, and we would go into a work site and measure these pollutants by putting little packs on the workers that they would wear during the day, and it would siphon air through these filters, and then we would analyze these filters when we got back to the laboratories in Cincinnati. And just it was fascinating work, but it really gave me a perspective on the American worker and things that the American worker must tolerate, to be employed in this country.
Makes our job look a lot easier, right?
It does. It does,
and
doesn't it?
That's a great point. We are thinking about a portable device, a wearable device that patients can wear, and we can actually measure things real time, so wherever they go, not just at home, but, at work or wherever they are. We were also thinking about our armed forces who are deployed overseas and exposed to horrific conditions.
Absolutely.
Where there's a lot of particulate matter, diesel fumes, burning fossil fuels. So there's some interest from the Department of Defense as well, and we're working on that. But that wearable technology, I think, is a really interesting idea. As our environment, we are seeing increased pollution and global warming and all these things and ozone levels that may be harmful for asthma and chronic conditions. It's hard to sometimes make the connection, but certainly there must be. And it must not just air quality, but water quality too.
The other thing I was wondering about is you didn't measure this as an outcome, but looking at the sense of smell and olfaction and the impacts of pollutants on olfaction. I don't know about the literature in that realm either, but it seems to be one of those aspects of humanity that might be impacted by pollution.
Right. That's a great idea. I definitely think we should study that. And it's one of the symptoms that patients suffer from losing, olfaction.
Yeah. That's what I hear about a lot from patients who are in environments like that, is they will present to my clinic and discuss issues with their sense of smell in particular, just an anecdotal observation over the years, but certainly might be worth studying. Well, gosh, Stella, thank you so much. The work is really interesting, and I think, as you said, you're just starting down a pathway here that I think will gain more and more traction with time. I think work like this is really fundable, and I think you're leaning towards the Department of Defense makes a whole lot of sense in that regard. I wish you certainly the best of luck as you go down this pathway. Thanks again for joining me on the podcast.
Much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. Scope It Out is a co-production of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology and Wiley. All opinions in this podcast are those of Dr. Smith and his guests and do not necessarily reflect those of Wiley or of the sponsors.